Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, your host. There was a time when there was a broad public consensus on our role in the world and the way in which we'd advance our national security goals. But that consensus is threatened now by political and ideological divides at home. How can we bridge divides when it comes to core security concerns? Joining me to discuss this question is Susan Rice. She's the former National Security Advisor to President Obama, and she previously served as a U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. My conversation with Ambassador Rice was made possible by a grant from the Stanley Langendorf Foundation. The grant is in the name of Richard and Judith Guggenheim. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation.
Many of the dangers we face are transnational in nature, and they require a collaborative response. Yet it feels as though we have not been wildly respectful of the NATO alliance or fully understood its value and its importance to us. Do you see a way for which, or do you have advice for ways for which President Trump could maybe heal some of those divides, since we know, I mean, it's so central to our own security and our values?
I think let's begin with where your question started, which is that so many of the challenges we face internationally, whether it's fighting terrorism or dealing with the risk of weapons proliferation, or even, you know, combating a pandemic flu, or certainly dealing with the climate change, or transnational criminal organizations, all of these are what we know as transnational threats, meaning they can arise anywhere in the world and spread to anywhere in the world. And the only way to deal with them is not just through alliances, as critical as those are, but through cooperative solutions that involve countries large and small. Because, you know, if you get a SARS virus that emerges in Laos, you want, even in a place as small and, you know, remote as Laos, at least a government willing to collaborate with the international community to try to contain and detect and stamp out a disease. And then the question is, do they have the ability, even if they have the will? And if they don't have the ability, how do we help them? Similarly with terrorists, when you think about terrorists flowing from various parts of the world into Syria or Iraq or Afghanistan, to stop those foreign fighter flows requires a willing and preferably able government. So we need countries around the world, large and small, friend and foe, allies and not, to be bought into certain collaborative understandings when it comes to shared threats. And so that's a larger challenge, and it's one that we've been dealing with for many years. Within that, our alliances are a critical cornerstone. Because take some of the issues that we dealt with during the Obama administration. We dealt with the rise of ISIS and the need to build a coalition to roll back ISIS in Iraq and Syria. Well, who do we turn to first? We built a coalition ultimately of over 65 countries, but the core of it began with NATO, and it began with some of our most valuable Asian allies, like the Australians. When we had to deal with Russia invading Ukraine, we weren't going to get United Nations sanctions or other collective measures because Russia, of course, has a veto in the UN. So again, beginning with NATO, beginning with the European Union, beginning with our G7 partners, that was the foundation that we built to put together an ad hoc regime of sanctions that was impactful but wasn't global. So for all myriad of issues and challenges, we need our core allies in Europe and Asia to work with us. And so the answer to your question, what do we do? How do we reinvigorate the alliance? Well, first of all, we have to recognize what the shared threats are and take them seriously. And of course, unfortunately, in the current environment, NATO's relevance vis-a-vis Russia is greater than ever. And we need to understand and appreciate that, you know, that Russia does pose a continued and new type of threat. And I think what the president can best do is to stop talking about and treating NATO as if it is a financial transaction. It is a collection of countries that share values and interests. And we have agreed to support each other and stand by each other. The only time that has ever been invoked, as you know, was after 9/11, when the Allies came to our support and defense in Afghanistan. And we need to reassure our allies that we will be with them when they need it, as they have been with us. And not, you know, whether they are paying, you know, 2% of their GDP or not. We committed in 2014, we, the NATO alliance, when President Obama was in office, that by 2024, all NATO countries were supposed to spend at least 2% of their GDP on their military. And we're on track to get there. But, you know, what President Trump has done is suggested that they're remiss because they haven't yet gotten there. Or, in some instances, he suggested, let's raise it to 4%, which would be completely unachievable. So I think we need to have consistent messaging around the value we attach to the alliance, the critical importance it is for us, and make clear, yes, we need and expect those allies to meet their targets at 2%, but not because we are paying for their security, but because we have a mutual interest in being secure in our territory and our values.
There's another way in which we put our European allies in a difficult position, and that was the decision to withdraw from the Iran nuclear agreement and then impose secondary sanctions so that if a European company continued to do business with Iran, they would be sanctioned. Talk about that particular mechanism. Are there ways around it that we could offer? Because right now, Europeans are to some extent trying to do a workaround, so they're not pushed in a position in which they can, their choice is to either do business with us or do business with Iran, can't do both. Is there a middle ground that the administration should be thinking about, or should we put our allies in that position?
Well, no, we shouldn't put our allies in the position of being punished for upholding a deal that we all signed on to. And there's a fundamental illogic to this. By every measure, whether you're the U.S. intelligence community or the International Atomic Energy Agency, everybody who has looked at this agreed, and even the administration hasn't disputed, that Iran was upholding the terms of the nuclear deal. And the nuclear deal was designed for a very specific purpose, to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. It was not designed, and it could not have been designed, to deal with all of Iran's other nefarious activities. But the theory of the case, which everybody who backed the deal understood at the time, was that an Iran that might be supporting terrorism or meddling in its neighborhood or destabilizing our allies, it was far more dangerous with the capacity to develop a nuclear weapon than without it. And so that problem was in a box that was succeeding. Now we've opened the box and we have penalized our allies for doing nothing other than upholding the terms that they and we committed to. That is fundamentally problematic, not only because it undermines our alliance relationships, but what it does is say to countries that make commitments with us and or on our behalf that our word is not good. And think about the message that sends to North Korea. If North Korea were ever inclined, and we can talk about that, and it's a big question, to do a deal for its nuclear program, one of the things they ought to be asking themselves is there a risk that 5 years, 2 years, 10 years down the road, the United States or another country that signed on changes its mind and abrogates the whole thing after the deed has been done? And that does not inspire confidence, and it doesn't strengthen our ability to use diplomacy to solve the world's most pressing problems.
Right. So after Iran has, in fact, met its obligations and sort of rolled back its nascent program, then we pulled the plug.
Let's talk about North Korea for one, and I'm going to go back to Iran. North Korea, we had a situation where the president, in essence, declared victory before anything was achieved. What do you think...
It's happened before, by the way.
It's happened before?
Mission accomplished.
Oh, mission accomplished. Oh, man. Yes, forgot that. What do you think... I mean, Secretary Pompeo knows how government works. He's an effective guy. It's now in his hands to move it forward. And the president could undermine him or could make it, could empower him to do the best job possible at that. What do you think are the long-term possibilities when you think about the, I should put it differently, when you think about the long-term ambitions of North Korea, when you think about the role that the possession of nuclear weapons gives them, what do you think that are their ambitions, and whether it is would ever be seen by them as in their interests to give up that particular chip?
Well, I'm very skeptical that North Korea is prepared to cut any deal that would accomplish what has long been the United States' goal, which is complete, verifiable, and irreversible denuclearization. I don't think it's likely that they will do that, because for this regime, which remains, you know, very poor, completely authoritarian, in their minds, their nuclear arsenal has become an existential security blanket. Having said that, I think we should absolutely be trying diplomacy to test whether perhaps sanctions or changes of calculations within North Korea have or might in the future lead them to a different readiness. And so I am not one to argue that we should not be doing diplomacy. I think it was unorthodox and a high-risk gamble for the president to sit down one-on-one with Kim Jong-un as the opening gambit. I would have been much happier if they had note takers in there. But having said that, it's worth a try. But I think we can't walk into it, you know, with anything other than our eyes wide open and recognize that this is a long shot, and it requires a whole lot more than personal chemistry, if there is that, between the two leaders. And that walking out and blindsiding the Pentagon and our allies by suspending our exercises, which are there to help us be ready to defend South Korea and help South Korea defend itself, and declare, in effect, mission accomplished, was a serious misstep. And now, unfortunately, we see in the press yesterday that we've had to cancel the latest round of talks that was planned between Secretary Pompeo and his North Korean counterpart. Why? Presumably because there wasn't anything to talk about. And Pompeo went to Pyongyang, had another happy meeting with Kim Jong-un, and this meeting was supposed to be to prepare the summit, the next summit, which just seems like a lot of summits without a lot accomplished in between, but the next summit between the leaders. And I think we were so stuck that the administration, and North Korea sort of resumed its threats of late, that the administration concluded, I think appropriately, that this was not a ripe moment to continue those discussions. But it indicates how very fraught and high risk and long shot this approach is.
In the meantime, are we seeing a softening of when it comes to the sanctions on the part of both the Chinese and the Russians?
Apparently so, yes. I mean, I'm not privy to the same degree of granular information that I once was, but from even what is available in public sources, it seems that the Russians and the Chinese have taken their foot off the gas in terms of sanctions enforcement. And even the South Koreans they're not doing anything that violates UN sanctions, to my knowledge, but they are taking steps on a bilateral basis that bring down some of the restrictions that they've previously had in place. So we are also at risk of the coalition that has effectively implemented and enforced these sanctions becoming divided and irresolute.
And what does Kim need? I mean, he needs to know that there won't be regime change. Surely that is his fear. That's why he has nuclear weapons, I assume, or has pursued this capability. They say that what's highest on his agenda is to have a real peace treaty involving the those involved in the Korean War. Is there, in your mind,
an economic, well, not just economic relief, sanctions relief, but the prospects of investment in economic growth?
Yeah, and President Trump did a lot of talking about condominiums after visiting there. So yeah,
they got a lot of coastline.
So I'm going to take you back to Iran because it might be better for condominiums. The President Trump has been very open about his desire to in essence crush Iran economically. And so I wonder if that's in our interest. And let me just say why. Well, you've got this horrifying war and humanitarian disaster in Yemen. You've got the war in Syria. You still have an unstable Iraq. Could we afford an Iran that was failing and collapsing?
No. But before I dive into that, think about what can be accomplished by crushing Iran economically, if that is even feasible. And I'm not convinced it is. If you're Iran, the first thing you're going to do, if the economic pressure becomes overwhelming, is to play to those within the society, meaning the hardliners and the IRGC, who have the ability to remove the leadership if they so desired. And to play to them, you would give them what they want, which is the opportunity to restart the nuclear program. So the first casualty of a really effective economic squeeze on Iran is likely to be a resumption of the very threat we were trying to prevent. That's the first problem. It's not going to do anything to reduce Iran's support for terrorism or its efforts to destabilize its neighbors. It's going to increase the likelihood of conflict between Iran and Saudi or Iran and Israel and the like, which could well draw us in. So we solve nothing and we create additional problems. Now, I'm all for pressuring Iran to deal with all the other aspects of its nefarious behavior, its support for terrorism, its regional destabilization, its human rights record. And we had sanctions still in effect that remained after the nuclear deal to deal with all those things. And there are many other ways we can pressure Iran. But we could have done so while at least keeping that particular challenge in the box. If Iran were in fact to collapse, which I think is a improbability, it would be disastrous. It would make Syria look like a day at the beach, given the size of the population, given its geostrategic location, given its ability to export instability and violence. And it would, you know, run counter to our long-term interest, which is, of course, an Iran that is more open, more democratic, more respectful of human rights, and that allows the extraordinary talents of the Iranian people to be realized, which we say is our objective. I don't see a path from here to there, or even any preferable way stations in between, if our approach is purely to try to crush them economically.
And of course, one of the reasons we are working so closely with the Saudis is that they share that desire to push back Iran. Talk about that alliance right now. Here we are right after the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. We're faced with this kind of horrifying humanitarian crisis in Yemen, the targeting of civilians with some of our weapons. And so what should our relationship be with the Saudis in the face of these two factors?
Well, let me just underscore that Saudi Arabia has long been an important partner of the United States. It is not an ally. And it's an important distinction because, you know, a treaty ally, and I use the term judiciously, is one that we are obliged to come to the defense of in the event of a conflict. We do not have that arrangement with Saudi Arabia, and it's probably a good thing given how they're behaving in the region. Now, we have voluntarily supported Saudi Arabia when it was facing rocket attacks by the Houthis into its territory from Yemen, and that's how we started into our support for what the Saudis are doing in Yemen, and it's gone downhill. It's been a slippery slope. But frankly, that began under the Obama administration when we were involving ourselves initially for the narrow purpose of trying to help the Saudis defend themselves from this Houthi threat.
And weren't we concerned about Al-Qaeda and ISIS?
We were concerned about Al-Qaeda, but we were dealing with that separately. And so that's not an explanation for how we became involved in Yemen. But we now have, in my estimation, a Saudi Arabia as a partner that not only entails all of the contradictions and challenges to our values that we've long faced with our partnership with Saudi Arabia. It's human rights abuses, it's treatment of women, it's housing and or nurturing of extremism, extremist Wahhabism. All of those things remain. But on top of that, we now have, in Mohammed bin Salman, a crown prince who is reckless and dangerous, and who's seemingly absolutely unfettered. The Khashoggi thing is the most egregious and proximate example. But he is the author of the war in Yemen. It was his brainchild, and he's prosecuted it every step of the way, brutally and horribly. You know, he's the one that kidnapped the Lebanese prime minister for a few days. He's the one that locked up, you know, much of the royal family and extorted billions out of them. He's the one that has imprisoned women activists after, he took great credit for allowing them to drive. He is the one that got into a debilitating conflict with Canada over literally two tweets. So he is
something we'd never do.
One day we could tweet something that could set him off. I guess the royal we when we talk about tweets. But we have hitched our wagon to this 33-year-old leader, because his father's not leading, that I think could drive Saudi Arabia off a cliff and us with him if we don't pull back. So I've recently argued that it's time to distance ourselves, from not from Saudi Arabia as much as from Mohammed bin Salman, preferably in partnership with our allies, and to try to either change his approach or change the calculus within the Saudi royal family that has given him so much leash, because that he has irrefutably demonstrated how dangerous he is.
And I think they have reason to believe that that members of the Trump family feel close to him. That he does have cover.
Yeah, I think so.
let me just stay in that painful part of the world and turn to Syria for a moment. Responsibility to protect is a doctrine that it is a norm that says, in essence, that every sovereign state has got a responsibility to protect their citizens from mass atrocities. And if they fail to do that, that the international community has both the right and perhaps even the obligation to intervene, as long as intervening does not cause more harm than good. In the case of Syria, was there an opportunity to get in there to intervene, maybe in the early days, that would have done more good than harm? Or were we faced with that dilemma?
Well, I think first, there's so many parts to that question and to Syria more broadly. First of all, I think most folks know that the responsibility to protect is sort of an academic and normative theory. It's not got any foundation, unfortunately, in international law. It has never been applied in practice in a meaningful way. But what we do have is, as we found in the case of Libya, for example, when the international community authorizes an intervention for humanitarian purposes or for other purposes, then there's a legal basis. Syria is in my view, the worst case exhibit of collective failure that one can point to in modern times. And not just collective failure to protect civilians, although that's obvious and egregious, but collective failure to address a conflict that has such humanitarian and strategic implications. In an ideal world, and what we work very hard to accomplish, was that we could have brought the international community together through the Security Council, at least to sanction Assad and his activities, to launch, you know, investigations that could have put pressure on his behavior in the early days. But we had, you know, during the Obama administration, if I'm not mistaken, six instances in which the Russians, most often joined by the Chinese, vetoed resolutions that were far short of employing the use of force, but just to have some collective resolve on Syria. We spent extraordinary amounts of time, despite those failures, trying to work with the Russians to accomplish a negotiated solution. On the question of military intervention, I think you have to be precise in how you address it and how you pose a question. Could or should the United States have intervened militarily in Syria early on? By early on, I assume you mean 2011, maybe 2012. The Syria uprising began literally weeks after we took action, started to take action in Libya. So these would have been simultaneous. And for quite a while, it wasn't the grotesque, raging civil war that we now know it to be. So if the United States had decided, and obviously these are all issues and questions that we wrestled with, to intervene, say, in 2012, militarily, then what we would have been doing is deciding to launch a war to remove Assad and to end the violence. And I don't think anybody who knows Syria intimately thinks that is something that could have been accomplished via an air war. There's a difference with Libya if you're asking yourself, well, why could we do it in Libya and not in Syria? The answer is, in Libya, there was a rebel force on the ground that was sizable, coherent, and better than the government. There was no such thing. There was no size, coherence, or superiority. So there was no ground force to harness through air power. So it would have required us going in on the ground, very much like we tried to do to take out Saddam Hussein in Iraq. And I can tell you that when we looked at this, we decided that given our interests, given the costs and the risks of, you know, an invasion and occupation on the scale of Iraq or greater, that was not a wise choice.
As you think about Russia's approach, I mean, initially in not supporting any kind of resolution, how might their thinking have been affected by the experience with Libya? Because in the case of Libya, they did give us a pass, right? They didn't veto, and a responsibility to protect mission soon became regime change. I mean, it became clear you couldn't keep Gaddafi and avoid atrocities. Do you think that experience of having led an ally, you know, a friend of theirs, Libya, be invaded by NATO in the way it was?
Or wasn't really a friend. Wasn't a friend of Russia.
So say something about it was the thinking about one, did one affect the thinking about the other?
It's so funny because I was having this very conversation this morning with Ambassador Mike McFaul, who was our ambassador to Russia. And we were sort of, I don't know how we got on the topic of Libya, but you know, why was it, we were asking ourselves, that the Russians actually gave us the ability and the opportunity to get that very robust resolution through the Security Council? I was the ambassador at the UN at the time. Mike McFaul was not yet the ambassador to Russia. He was the senior person on the National Security Council staff working on Russia. And I'll tell this story. We really did not know whether we were going to be able to get that resolution through. And the night before the vote, the permanent five ambassadors gathered at the French mission to the UN. We were having a meeting, and the French convened it, and we were going to talk about Libya and sequencing and timing. And the Russian ambassador pulled me aside and said to me, "Susan, I want to let you know that I think my government is not going to block this resolution." And I looked at him, and I knew him very well, and I said, "Really?" And what I'm thinking is, why
That's
are you...
ambassador speak, so I just...
Why are you telling me this? Because the Russians never tell us in advance, more than 5 minutes before a vote, if that much, how they're going to vote on something controversial. I said, "Well, what do you think the Chinese are going to do?" He says, "Oh, I think they also won't block it." And I'm thinking to myself, this is something here does not add up. This is not how they normally roll. And I'll tell you, quite honestly, my theory, and I just said, you know, this is what I was running through my head as I'm standing there talking to Ambassador Churkin, is they think we are going to get bogged down, and they're giving us just enough rope to hang ourselves. That was my theory. Conversation with Mike today doesn't necessarily dispute that theory, but his view is that there was a split in Russia. This was still when Medvedev was president. And Medvedev was on board with letting this go through. And from day one or two, Putin was against it. He was then prime minister and, of course, you know, waiting to come back. And I think that there's also another theory of it, is that Medvedev did it for the right reasons. Putin set him up and blamed him for letting this go through. And then when things unfolded, as we told them they would, we were very clear. They like to pretend now, their narrative is that we did a bait and switch on them, that we didn't tell them what we were going to do. I've got witnesses, like 14 other countries, and all of their staff in the room when I explained in great detail what we were going to do and how this was not going to be, you know, a no-fly zone or pinprick airstrikes, that we were going to take out military, we're going to take out all these targets. I went through it all. And I said, and I'm telling you this because I don't want to hear that, you know, that we pulled the wool over your eyes. Here's what this entails. So, but the Russian narrative has been since that we did what we did much more than we promised we or said we were going to do. And Putin has used this to great effect. He used it in part. Mike's comment was that, you know, that was the beginning of the end of Medvedev. And Putin's narrative is that Libya was the worst thing that has ever happened and that we were, you know, we were to blame. And we heard about Libya, you know, every time there was a conversation between the leaders for the next, you know, 5 years. Yeah. So that's their narrative. But the truth of the matter is that to the Russians, Libya and Syria are night and day. They had no big interest in Libya. They had no brief for Gaddafi. They had no bases in Libya. They really didn't care about Libya. And they didn't like Gaddafi. But Syria is theirs. And they have long held very serious military facilities in Syria. Assad was their guy, is their guy. And there's no, I mean, if nothing had ever happened in Libya, I'm quite convinced they would be doing exactly the same thing in Syria.
We've been hearing from the former National Security Advisor to President Obama, Susan Rice. We're talking about political polarization here at home and how it might impact our ability to address threats from abroad. After the break, we'll consider how to separate politics from policy. Thank you. You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from Susan Rice. She's the former National Security Advisor to President Obama, and she previously served as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. To hear this broadcast or any other World Affairs program that you may have missed, you can download our podcasts on our iTunes channel or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs, that's one word. And now back to our program.
So let's talk about Russia. First, let's talk about Washington a little bit. I've been struck by the fact that the Russian interference in our election is not being treated as a national security threat, but instead as a domestic partisan issue on the Hill. Do you have a sense that will continue, that way of thinking about it will continue, or do you expect with a new Congress that we will actually take the steps we need to take to prevent that kind of interference, or have us at least have eyes wide open about what's being done?
Well, first of all, I think that even though there have been those in Congress that have downplayed the Russian threat, and frankly did from August of 2016, Mitch McConnell in particular, when we first went to try to enlist, the administration first went to try to enlist the bipartisan leadership of Congress in helping communicate to the American people on a bipartisan basis the nature of the threat we were facing. He was very dismissive of it. Paul Ryan was
not.
Mitch McConnell. Paul Ryan was not so dismissive. He was more where you would expect him to be. But in fairness, many in Congress, even on both sides of the aisle, have acknowledged the seriousness of the Russian threat to our electoral systems and have adopted certain steps, though not enough, to acknowledge that. What has happened, what has become politicized and partisan are the investigations into the Russian threat, particularly on the House side, less so but not completely on the Senate side. And that's a shame. It gets back to my original opening discussion about our domestic political divisions and how they exacerbate threats to our national security. I think it's very, very problematic and regrettable that because the perception, I think, among some is that any investigation is going to implicate or has the risk of implicating folks in the administration or folks tied to the Trump campaign in 2016, that they have chosen to politicize it, villainize it, and delegitimize it. And that's a huge problem because we need to understand exactly what happened and we need to take measures to defend against it. I am not especially optimistic that this will change with the new Congress. The partisan divide on this. Obviously, with Adam Schiff and the Democrats in charge of the House Intelligence Committee, they will pursue a serious and credible investigation, and they'll have a lot more ability to do so. But the reaction from, I think, the other side of the aisle and from the administration, if anything, will probably be more polarized and vitriolic. What is going to be interesting to see is what happens on the Senate side, because their investigation is still ongoing. It's being run by Senator Richard Burr from North Carolina and Mark Warner of Virginia. And they have tried, with considerable, if not complete, success, to manage that investigation on a bipartisan basis. And I hope that will continue, but you know that's against the backdrop of the firing of Sessions and the installation of perhaps the unconstitutional installation of a political crony as acting attorney general and all that might pretend to be determined for the Mueller investigation. So we may be into a whole new level of crazy.
You mentioned before when we were talking about North Korea that you wish there had been note takers in there when the two leaders met. Consistently, when President Trump meets with President Putin, there are not note takers. What do you make of that? What is lost? What is at risk? Say something
about
that.
It's unbelievable. I mean, it's National Security Advisor. I would have thrown my body on the tracks in order to ensure that I or somebody else was in the meeting with the President of the United States and the Russian leader. I don't care who the president is. It is criminal negligence to leave the President of the United States with no note taker in a meeting with a sworn adversary, whether Putin or Kim Jong-un. Why? Because the other side can come out and claim that you said anything they want, and you have no fundamental way to refute it. And add to that, in this instance, that we have a president whose relationship with the facts is constantly questionable. And therefore, if it was a he said, who's anybody going to believe? Really, we wouldn't know. And we can't, in the best of circumstances, put ourselves in that position, and especially not now. So I hope to God that, you know, John Bolton, as National Security Advisor, does not let that happen again. It should never have happened in the first place. And it's mind-boggling to me that we have to have this conversation.
So I want to turn to another great power, and that's China. When the Clinton administration first came in, President Clinton had, as a candidate, had been very critical of China because of Tiananmen on human rights, because of human rights concerns. But of course, when you get into office, you then realize China's there, and the question is how to work with them most effectively. You can say in the worst of times with the Soviet Union, we work together on arms control. In the worst of times with China, we can work together on a whole range of issues like sustainable development. Talk about our relationship now.
Well, first of all, I've often said, and President Obama has often said, I think many have said, that the U.S.-China relationship is the most consequential in the world today, because of the size of our economies, the capacity of our militaries, although ours is much greater than theirs still, so don't be fooled about that. But also our role as two very important global powers that interact on virtually every dimension that one can envision. And when the United States and China are able to row in the same direction and work together, whether on the Paris Climate Agreement or on nuclear security or on fighting the Ebola epidemic, as we did together in West Africa, the United States obviously more important in that than China, but China was present, or on peacekeeping issues, or you name it. When we are pulling in the same direction, Iran nuclear deal, North Korea, which at times we have, our ability to pull others with us and to maximize our collective success, going back to the foundation of the fact that these threats are transnational and we need partners, the U.S. and China working together is a really powerful combination. The U.S. and China at odds is a really powerful problem as well, whether economic or military. And so the challenge has long been, much more so now that China is growing in its economic and military capacity and its global ambitions, is to manage this consequential relationship effectively. That means we are inevitably going to compete in various realms, economic for sure, strategic in all likelihood. We've got to figure out how to manage that competition responsibly and wisely to the extent we can, and not stumble into conflict. But we also need to be able to cooperate where we can. And we need to find that balance between competition and cooperation. I believe, and I think we were able to demonstrate the value of this during the Obama administration, that there is a balance that can be struck, that we could cooperate on a number of things, even as we were competing in some very serious ways economically, disagreeing over South China Sea, disagreeing over cyber theft, a number of other issues. But that need not morph into conflict. I think we're in a somewhat different place now, quite honestly. I think China has signaled a will and a capacity to be much less constrained internationally and to push the boundaries. The economic competition is intensifying, and I don't think we're managing it wisely in terms of, you know, in this serial succession of tariffs and doing so without our allies and partners with us. We're fighting them on one front and China on another rather than fighting collectively to advance our shared economic interests. And so I think we are at a point where the U.S.-China relationship could, as Vice President Pence suggested, evolve into a really serious new Cold War, or it could be brought back from the brink. And I don't know exactly which way it's going to go.
Talk about tariffs. When it comes to China, I think in general, Republicans and Democrats feel that it has been very irresponsible and sort of in capturing our intellectual property and not always paying by the rules. And so you're not hearing the kind of squawking you normally hear when our country imposes tariffs on another country. But
we are hearing squawking.
So tell us about the squawking, because we're not hearing it as far out here in the country. And
your wine industry out here, I mean, our wine industry is going to be next in line. So go to New England and talk to the lobster.
Yes.
Lobstermen out there. Huh? Or go to the Midwest and...
And those producing soybeans.
Right.
Absolutely. So who do tariffs harm? What is the potential benefit in slapping tariffs on like this? Talk a little bit about that with respect to China, but also in other situations.
Well, tariffs are a tax, quite basically. And so the first people to pay the tax are us, the consumers and taxpayers. And so we all find that the goods we have to pay for and the inputs to those goods are more expensive. So we lose in the first instance, all of us. And then particular industries and sectors lose depending on how the retaliation comes. And then, of course, those who benefit, for example, those that have benefited from the steel and aluminum tariffs, not only with respect to China, but with respect to our European and North American partners, actually benefit very selectively. So it depends what kind of steel you're in. You know, if you utilize formed steel to make another steel product, you're in trouble. If you're, if you're forging steel in the first instance, you might be in better shape. So these tariffs are very blunt instruments that hurt everybody broadly on some level and only selectively help certain industries and sectors. There's a reason why tariffs are shunned, because they do have a negative knock-on effect for the larger economy. And in this instance, as I said earlier, the biggest problem that I see, in addition to there doesn't seem to be any strategy to de-escalate, is that we have not approached this in lockstep with the European Union, with Japan, with South Korea, with Canada, with all the countries that share our concerns about many of China's practices. Rather, we are fighting them on multiple fronts instead of uniting them to increase the pressure and therefore the efficacy of our pressure on China.
Several of the question cards that have come up to me from the audience relate to the sort of the rise of nationalism, populism, kind of populist politics, and in fact the problem of illiberal democracies that are democracies in the sense that people vote, folks are elected,
but they don't have the same sort of rule of law and the same commitment to pluralism that we might have. One questioner has asked, how concerned should we be about Hungary, Poland, perhaps the role of the migrant crisis in prompting a kind of a nationalistic response? How concerning is this? Is this likely to be to spread?
I think it is concerning. I think it is spreading. And we are not well positioned to roll back that spread, because I think if you polled countries around the world, they would say that we're on that same path. And I think we've got to fix our own house, but we've also got to resume our traditional role of being clear and forceful in our support for democracy and human rights, and our, you know, belief in the rule of law and the freedom of the press, and the fact that we cannot allow our institutions to be manipulated or corrupted. So part of it is leading by example. Part of it is also having a strong sense of values and interests. And I'm worried that at a time when there are exogenous reasons why many of these countries are going in the wrong direction, i.e. towards illiberal democracy, that we are accelerating that trend by not standing against it as we normally would. And I think in a place like Hungary or Poland, it's a serious problem because they are NATO allies. And as most of you know, for decisions to be made in NATO, any decision, but for Article 5 in particular to be invoked, requires consensus. So one can envision nightmare scenarios in which, when we need consensus to deal with an external adversary, it's difficult, if not impossible, to obtain it.
Some of the signs of moving toward an illiberal democracy are, one, the erosion of norms, sort of the basic rules by which we play, stated and unstated. But the other are efforts to discredit institutions, the media, for example. You know, part of the reason the media is declining in respect and trust has to do with technology and how it has restructured the media. But part of it is purposeful efforts to discredit. As you see that happening, is that an important responsibility of the United States to restore, maintain trust in independent institutions that are essential actors in our democracy?
I mean, absolutely. We are a nation of laws. We are a nation of institutions that are protected by laws. And we are a country that is founded on fundamental freedoms, one of which is freedom of expression and freedom of the press, freedom of association. To the extent that all of these are being challenged and or actively eroded, including from the podium and the East Room in the White House, we're in deep trouble.
You were asked by Evan Osnos of The New Yorker whether you would run for Susan Collins' Senate seat in Maine. There are only about two Maine voters out there, but we'll go.
Not even, I bet.
You said you wouldn't even think about it until after the midterms. We're after the midterms. So now's your chance to announce.
But you think I'm going to announce for the Maine Senate from San Francisco? How dumb do I look? Am I going to be part of that, of the solution? I think we all need to be part of the solution. Yes, I very much want to be part of the solution in terms of trying to heal these divisions and making our democracy functional and putting country over party and finding basis for unity and recognizing that, that for better or for worse, there's no ability for us to divorce each other in this country unless we want to literally drive off a cliff into civil conflict. We are in this boat together, and this boat is a diverse and vibrant collection of people of all backgrounds and all nationalities and all races and all religions and all sexual orientations, and immigrants from everywhere, and people like me, who half of my family came over as immigrants and half came as slaves. We are all that diversity. And if we don't find ways to figure out, again, how to talk to each other and how to trust each other, even when we disagree, and recognize that we are in it together, then we have a very worrying future ahead of us. And I will say that, you know, for me, you know, in my personal life and in my professional life, this is as high a priority as any. I come from a diverse family, not just racially and nationally. I'm married to a man originally from Canada, and I've got biracial children. I come from a politically mixed family now, that I have a college-age child whose views differ from that of his parents.
That's a great way to rebel.
So I'm living this every day. Thank God there's a coast, that we are separated by the coast, but I love my son dearly. But we don't agree on many political issues. And yet we are a family and we love each other and we talk to one another and we support each other. That is, on a very micro level, the analogy that we need to create nationally. And when you look at this last midterm election, there were candidates that were running on the basis of unity and collective responsibility and shared values. And they were candidates that were running on fear and division and hate. And if unity doesn't win over division and hope over hate, we're in trouble. So I am going to work in my kitchen at my Thanksgiving dinner table. And in the work that I do as a national security expert and leader to try to bridge those divides. And if I think I can contribute through elected office, I'll do it. But I think there are many, many more ways than through elected office.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured a conversation with Susan Rice. She's the former National Security Advisor to President Obama and previously served as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.